It's interesting now, though, because every time I mouthwash, even if physically maybe I didn't have to go to the bathroom before, as soon as the mouthwash hits my mouth, my brain is now queued up with time to go to the bathroom. So it's interesting the power that habits and routines really have on us, even when we don't recognize it.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
We're back again for episode 2 of Solving Systems.
Welcome back.
Today we're going to be talking about habits and routines, something that kind of underlies everything that we do in our daily lives.
Absolutely. I mean, how many of us have routines that we enact every day, day after day after day, and yet are we aware of them? Are we doing them as efficiently and effectively as possible? Is there a need to do them efficiently and effectively? Maybe some things are time fillers. Maybe some things with a little bit of tweaking could lead to a more fulfilling daily existence and therefore stretch it out.
Right. And so many things, these things are subconscious that we don't realize that they're happening. And so just talking about them hopefully will help you, dear listener, find out where those routines lie.
Yeah. So what's the purpose of a routine? Why have a routine? Well, a lot of the work out there says, just as far as putting your brain on autopilot, mm-hmm. letting your brain not have to think about things like who thinks about the breaths that they take, who thinks about blinking, who thinks about how you drive out of the garage in the morning, all of the little things that go by day that allow your brain to focus on other matters.
Right. The way I like to think about it is that your brain is doubling down on something that works, and that causes you to be more efficient. So you might have a process that's not the best, theoretically, but because you trained yourself to do that, switching to something else would take too much effort. And therefore, you just continue with that because it's efficient enough.
Yeah, and then once those routines are in place, your brain knows that pathway, right? You enact it immediately, and you don't have to worry about all of the little things that come up. And with that extra space and that efficiency, the brain is able to handle more complex and important matters, theoretically.
Right. So let's talk about that. We kind of alluded to how there's a cue, there's a routine, and a reward. And this cycle is something that shows up in Charles Duhigg's book, The Power of Habit. It's a bestseller a few years ago. It'll be in the show notes. So the idea behind this is that there's always a cue that causes you to enact some routine that gives you some reward. For example, if I'm hungry, I'll wander to the kitchen, grab a bar of chocolate, and then the reward will be, well, I'm full now.
Yes. Or maybe in a less productive manner, I'm sitting in class, I'm bored because my teacher's droning on about some problem that I don't care about. So the cue is boredom. The routine is pull up my phone, access social media, and the reward is, theoretically anyway, fulfillment.
Right.
They also speak in the book about how that can develop into cravings. If you don't get the reward, you go through the routine and your brain is now expecting that reward. It doesn't just say, I'm good, I'm fine. It now expects it. It demands it. And this is maybe where some of our cravings and our unhealthy habits can start to be formed. I mean, smoking is the perfect example. A smoker looks at a pack of cigarettes, and as soon as the brain sees that pack of cigarettes, they say, gotta have it. Gotta have that nicotine. And if they don't, the brain doesn't just say, I'm cool, it's fine. It now expects that. And that's where people say, you know, I wish I could quit smoking. Well, do they really wish they could? Probably do on some level. And yet the brain is so hardwired with these habits that now it's become this unhealthy situation that people struggle with.
How much of that do you think is personality driven? Because some of it's got to be related to how your brain functions or how, you know, nature or nurture, regardless, somehow it's your brain is wired in a certain way.
Absolutely. So, well, I can speak to this from two standpoints. So in reflecting and thinking about this episode, I thought about my own brain, how it works and sort of the pitfalls and also maybe the positives. Both of my parents, so a little bit about me, both of my parents are former alcoholics. Recovering alcoholics. And And I heard a lot growing up about how alcoholism is genetic, how if your parents are alcoholics, you're more likely to be alcoholics yourself. And I think a lot of that boils down to a certain addictive personality. And putting that together with the idea of habits and routines, I think maybe, it's just Mr. Johnson speculating here, that maybe the habit loop in an addictive person is just a little bit tighter, just a little bit more closed. And maybe those people's brains just rely on those habits maybe a little bit more than everyone else. Now, that can be a good thing or a bad thing from my perspective. So the bad, the obvious, what we think of when we think of addictive personalities, you've got alcoholism, you've got gambling, you've got drugs, you've got all of these things, OCD. It's just things where people are over the top. They can't seem to control their routines and their habits. There's also a fair amount of positives that can come from an addictive personality where habits really drive you. I mean, some historic examples of addictive personalities are Ben Franklin, Thomas Edison, Steve Jobs, Emily Dickinson. These are people who produced incredible, amazing things because they, if you have an addictive personality, if these habits sort of drive you, you are more likely to take risks. You are more likely to see the novelty in things. You are more likely to be leaders, and leaders do great things.
So what do you think, how do you think that splits up by internal and external motivation then? Because you would think habit loops are very internal, right? Something that your brain is just doing on its own. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes the reward is external.
Yes.
You want something from someone else, maybe.
Absolutely.
I'm guessing, you know, a lot of childhood development is where the reward is parental approval.
Yes. Well, and I will say, going back to my classroom, internal motivation is, in all of the research that I've ever done educationally, internal motivation is the big driver for long-term success. If you're just doing something to get a cookie, eventually the cookie isn't enough. You need two cookies, and then you need four cookies. Now, you can form habits externally, by motivating people externally. But essentially, the grade in a class is only so motivating. Right? Some people are motivated by grades, but oftentimes that's just masking something else, in my opinion. It's my parents expect me to do well. The grade represents me doing well, and so therefore I strive for the grade. But internal motivation is what it's really all about. If you can get to that level of internal motivation, then you don't have a problem. So it is, it's a balancing act. And it also sort of goes back to that nature-nurture situation, which is our brains are hardwired in a certain way. That's true. But we all know that the nurture, that the care that you receive growing up also plays an impact into that. So are great minds born or are they developed? Maybe it's some of both. It's hard to say.
So some of, relating back to addictive personality, some of that must be external then.
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, we know we're claiming that it's probably a little more internal, that the loops are tighter.
Sure.
But I'm just wondering, I guess, where the external factors come in there.
That's a great question. If we knew the answer, we'd probably just create an elixir and we just hand it out to people.
Right.
I don't know. I think there are certain, those external motivators can be a lot of different societal interventions that can take place. I mean, the quality of a great teacher in the life of a child can be remarkable. The benefit of a grandmother who steps into a family situation where that help is needed, how can you calculate that? A good friend, how can you calculate that? I think all of those interpersonal things that can sort of jump in at certain points can make a big difference. There's also things that can be done sort of within society, right? I mean, the external benefit of a child having food as opposed to not having food, immense difference. The difference between having healthcare and not having healthcare on a family, immense difference. Just having those learning opportunities outside of school, an immense opportunity. So can we point to one thing and say, this is the silver bullet? As with most cases, I think not. But I think that compilation and cobbling together of external factors and external motivators can really just bring out the best in what we already have between our ears.
Right. So external factors can shape our internal motivations too. Sure. So that's something we'll talk about later in the episode about how we can change our habits. It's something that the book we referenced earlier continues to go on about. So
sure.
I think that's a very interesting, I guess, applicable thing from talking about routines.
Absolutely.
So let's give some examples of routines.
Sure.
I guess I can start off with what I do in the morning. I think we both have morning routines.
Absolutely.
I think a lot of people have morning routines. This is one that you might not think about.
Right.
But if you're me, you wake up in the morning, actually almost at the same time every day.
Yep.
Even if I don't set an alarm, I find myself awake at 7:30 a.m. And I spend about 5 minutes on my phone, a habit I'm trying to break, but we'll see. And then I get out of bed, I brush my teeth, I have breakfast, and then, I rinse out my mouth, I use the restroom, take a shower, put on some clothes, and go to school.
Sure.
And it's the same routine every morning. I don't even have to think about it. Actually, last week, I, for some reason, ended up waking up a little later in order to, I think I was trying to get more sleep or something.
Sure.
And I had to put a post-it note on my phone telling me to not eat breakfast. That was part of my, I had decided ahead of time that for some reason I didn't need to have breakfast that day. So I had to do that because I knew I would default to eating breakfast and I would have lost those 15 minutes and it would be over, right?
Absolutely.
I'd be late to school.
Well, so. It's funny you talk about morning routines. I can say as a father of four children, my morning routine is a little less set thanks to their irregular sleep habits. We work hard as parents to enact good routines for our kids, go to bed at the same time, but kids get sick. They don't always follow the rules that I would like to set up. But I will tell you, my nighttime routine is pretty set in stone. So I brush my teeth, I floss, and now for those of you who know me, I'm not going to go off on a huge dental tangent here, but I don't quite understand how flossing really eliminates the bacteria. I'll leave that to the dentists of the world, the experts, if you will. But
about to get a lot of angry emails, I'm guessing,
I know. Yeah. I shouldn't have thrown that in there, but I had to. So I floss nightly, and then I mouthwash. And then I've actually thought about this routine and call this my addictive personality kicking in a little bit. But I've actually thought about my nighttime routine as far as making it as efficient as possible. Because quite frankly, every night I am dying to get to bed. So it's 10:30 at night. I'm exhausted. It's been a long day. I'm ready to be in bed. And oftentimes I'll try to beat my wife to bed because we go in at the same time and it is my goal on a nightly basis to try to get to bed before her. So I've thought about this routine. And so while I mouthwash they recommend 30 to 60 seconds, I think, I quickly take out my contacts, I go to the bathroom, I wash my hands, and then I lose the mouthwash. Therefore, maximizing the amount of time that mouthwash is in my mouth while being more efficient with what I'm doing. And oftentimes my wife is frustrated because she says, I always get into the bathroom first, and yet you always beat me to bed. Of course, I've made my routine as efficient as possible. So it's interesting now, though, because every time I mouthwash, even if physically maybe I didn't have to go to the bathroom before, as soon as the mouthwash hits my mouth, my brain is now queued up with time to go to the bathroom. So it's interesting the power that habits and routines really have on us, even when we don't recognize it. One other routine, speaking of bodily functions, since we're here and might as well throw it out there. For those of you who know me, I like to run. I like to go on long runs. And my routine now has become, and I realized it maybe a couple years ago, I would think, okay, time to go for a run. And originally I would go for a run and I'd realize, 2 miles from home with no access to restrooms, I have to go to the bathroom. Now, that's not a great place to be. So you're left with the decision of, do I run faster and try to get home in order to get to the bathroom, or do I move slower, therefore, reducing the amount of, what would we say?
Motion,
creating a troublesome situation. We'll just leave it at that. So I begin to build in the routine of, before I go for a run, I go to the bathroom. I take the time, I use the restroom. Now, every time that I have to, I decide I'm going for a run, 10 minutes later, I have to use the bathroom. So my brain is now adapted, and the way I figure the reward is not being 2 miles away from home, having to use the restroom. So that routine is now fixed in my life. And my wife jokes with me all the time when I say, oh, I'm going to go for a run. Why don't you head into the bathroom? Because they're now linked in my brain. It's now just a loop that my brain has sort of decided is very important for me. So what about math class, Nikhil?
Yes.
Any routines in a math class that you've noticed?
Yeah. So something I've noticed personally is sometimes there's a challenging question that you're working on or just something new that you're trying to learn. And it's usually, the goal is usually to reduce it to something you know how to do.
Sure.
So you'll take some new idea. And if you're struggling with all of the concepts in solving that problem, then it'll take a lot of mental brain power to, you know, get to the solution.
Absolutely.
But oftentimes, you just have to learn a step to attack the problem at first, and then the rest reduces to something that you know how to do. And so whenever I'm working on a math problem in general, I'll get to the point where the rest is just stuff I've done for years, and from there I'm not even thinking about it.
Yeah.
Suppose I end up with, like, I don't know, a system of equations.
Sure.
Solving that second nature at this point, and I don't have to think from there. So really the mental brain power, the amount of thinking that goes into it is all concentrated on the new concepts, which makes learning new concepts easier.
Sure. And while you have multiple pathways to solve that system, you probably have a preferred route that your brain immediately goes into autopilot for.
Right. And especially when, if I attack a problem and I realize that there's a way to get to a situation I know how to solve for sure, I'll choose that path instead of something that might be more creative, but I don't see the end immediately.
Absolutely.
And sometimes this can be bad because I could turn a, you know, 1 minute clever solution into a 10 minute problem with way too many numbers. So
absolutely. Well, and speaking of the classroom, I've got multiple routines within my classroom.
Mm-hmm.
The one that probably is the most interesting is the way I've organized my existence in the room. So going back maybe 5 years now. I tried as an unorganized person and a forgetful person, historically poor memory, I would always try to get more organized. And at some point I just let go of that a little bit. And in my decision-making process, where would I put a file folder? Where would I save something on my U drive? Where would I put this textbook? Now my go-to method, my go-to routine is, just put it somewhere. The first place I think to put it, that's where I'm going to put it. Because I realize at some point that my brain is going to quickly recall when I say, where is my 2016 practice AP test? I know where it is, right on my bookshelf next to the Audacity of Hope copy that I own. Why is it there? There's no logical reason. It's not next to the 2015. It's just for some reason, my brain said put it there. So it's a routine that I can follow for all of these different sort of things that I need to access, and yet allowing my brain to go into autopilot, allowing it to just go dead and not have to cognitively think, well, it's probably in this folder by that document, which makes sense. It's, I don't know, I keep my loose leaf paper in the top right-hand drawer of my desk. Why? I don't know. My brain decided that's where it would be, and it allows my brain to go into that autopilot, be more efficient, maybe, hopefully, be more effective.
Right. One thing about brains that's, I guess, kind of cool is you tend to think like you used to think a few months ago, even a few years ago, right?
Sure.
So you put it somewhere, and then the next time you think, oh, where would I put it if I were to put it there now? It'll probably be the same place. Exactly. Not much has changed, right?
No.
And so that's not a bad organization system.
I agree. And why are my razors right behind my Kleenex? There's no good reason. It's not alphabetized. It's not numeric. It's not by size. It's just my brain decided that's where it would be. And instead of trying to come up with a clever multi-tiered design for an organization system, why not just let the brain do what it's hardwired to do? So here's a question that I bet a bunch of our listeners would care for us to throw some answers to is, how are routines changed? How can we take the routines that we currently have, whether we're aware of them or we're just becoming aware of them, or we're not aware of them at all, how can we change those routines to be more effective and be more efficient? Any ideas, any suggestions?
Right. So in The Power of Habit, the book we referenced earlier, Charles Duhigg talks about changing the routine but preserving the cue and the reward. Mm. So he talks about habit loops, which are you go from a cue to a routine to a reward, and then later again you'll hit the cue again and the cycle repeats. So changing a routine would be changing that habit loop. So for example, instead of going to the kitchen and grabbing a bar of chocolate, maybe when I'm hungry I go and instead of having chocolate there I have like an apple. So I grab an apple and eat that, and I'm still full at the end. So I've preserved the cue, and I've preserved the reward. I've just changed what happens in between.
And I think a question that just thought of while you were saying that is, because most people who go to the kitchen because they're, quote, hungry, are really looking for that reward. Now, the question is, what is the reward? Is the reward really being full? Is that why we go for the chocolate? Probably not. I mean, what is the reward for the chocolate? I mean, the guess is it tastes delicious. I think we all agree. Many people would put chocolate right up at the top of the foods that they would enjoy eating, whereas apple may not be one of the first things we come up with. So maybe also recognizing what the real reward is an important step here. And I'm just speaking off the top [S2] Right. [S1] Of my head, but the routine being what it is, going to the kitchen, getting food, needs to match the reward and recognizing what the reward actually is in this situation.
And I think it's also recognizing what the cue really is.
Yeah.
Because I feel like a lot of people who are mindlessly going to the kitchen for food are actually doing that out of boredom.
Absolutely.
So the cue is probably boredom, not hunger.
Sure. So maybe not even going to the kitchen for an apple, maybe completely changing the paradigm
right.
and saying, I'll go for a walk.
Mm-hmm.
I'll play a game with my kids. I'll do some homework to eliminate the boredom.
Right.
That is really persistent there. I would argue, not as someone who owns a phone, but in observing people who do, oftentimes that is why people access their phones. Not out of a need to communicate, not out of a need to sort of enhance their chances in class as far as accessing my blog, but more often just kind of bored, or maybe I'm kind of nervous. That's another, I think, reason people would take out a device, and in order to sort of bridge that gap. So recognizing what's really at play there. Why are you really on Facebook? Why are you really eating that chocolate? Why are you really doing whatever the habit is? And maybe recognizing another way to reward yourself when that cue has sort of set in.
All right. I think related to social media, phones, and everything, mm-hmm. I think a large part of that is feeling insecure. I think there is, or just not wanting to be in that moment.
Sure.
So you might be out with people, but you know that your phone provides a certain amount of comfort, right?
Absolutely.
So the reward is established. You know every time you're going to get this reward, this dopamine hit.
Yes.
And because you have that established reward,
yes,
and the cue being something that makes you slightly uncomfortable,
sure,
you know that there's a way out.
And as we spoke about earlier, this habit loop makes our brain happy.
Right.
And if we're feeling uneasy, going into a habit, allowing our brain to sort of go dead a little bit, is a reassuring thing for the human body. So it makes sense that in a nervous situation, in a bored situation, in an unhappy situation, you would go to something, your brain would immediately say, let's find a cue, let's find a routine, let's find a reward that's going to sort of get rid of those feelings.
And then you feel uncomfortable when that routine no longer exists.
Absolutely.
Like, for example, I think a lot of our listeners can relate to this. If you don't have your phone on you, you feel like you're missing a part of yourself.
Oh, absolutely.
And you've lost access to that routine, to that reward.
Yes. Well, and there are times, especially I'm dealing with students in class, where they're on their phone. Mm-hmm. They're distracted. They're not doing math. If I take their phone, there are some people who are legitimately more distracted not having their phone than they are. I see them twitching. I see them nervous. They feel like they've lost a part of themselves because that backstop is gone. The safety net now is gone, and if they get in an uncomfortable spot, perhaps they don't have that safety valve to go to. So it's an interesting thing to think about as far as what role technology, phones, social media plays in our habits.
Do you think they're inhibiting us from creating new habits, possibly?
I think they're a crutch. I think they're probably a crutch for a lot of us in social situations, in any time you're dealing person to person, that when I get uncomfortable, I go to that habit, I go to that loop, instead of maybe a more productive habit, looking someone in the eye and talking to them, having a deep and meaningful conversation. We go to that technology. Any more than I'm feeling bored, I should go exercise. No, I'm feeling bored, I'm going to have chocolate. Right? The habits can be used, I think, and the routines can be used in multiple ways, healthy and unhealthy. Now, it's up to every person individually, I think, to decide what's a healthy routine. When is it good to go brain dead, right? If I'm backing my car out of the driveway, this is something they list in The Power of Habit as well as an example. If I'm pulling my car out of the driveway, there are many, many steps that my brain needs to go through if I'm actively thinking about it. The first time you get behind the car, mm-hmm. they say, it's tough, it's a very difficult task for you to do. Now, when you've done it for 1,000 times, your brain's got it figured out. Now, that's a good thing, right? We don't have to consciously remember, okay, go to reverse, check both mirrors, look over my shoulder. Maybe some of us should, but fairness, we don't have to do that. Now, that's good. That's more efficient. It's more effective. We don't have to worry about it. But if we just go completely brain dead and we're always in those habit loops, that's not healthy either. So I think it's fair to pose the question, is social media, are our phones inhibiting us in some ways that maybe we don't even realize? Mm-hmm. Some of those routines breaking down that maybe we don't even recognize.
And on the flip side, though, there are ways that technology can make us adapt healthy habits.
Sure.
I think one of the things that I tried out recently was an app called Streaks.
Streaks. So is that kind of like, hold on. I'm going to show my foolishness here, and I apologize to the listeners, but I hear my students talking about Snapchat streaks all the time. Is similar or different?
They're similar, actually. I mean, they're different apps, right? Okay. Snapchat is separate from this app that I'm talking about, which is called Streaks.
Okay.
But the idea is very similar. So in Snapchat, one of the things that two people can do is have a streak, which is where you snap each other once every day, basically.
Sure, yeah. And it can be meaningless.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. I mean, or
someone. Or it can be meaningful.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure. Yes.
Right. So the idea here is you're making a streak with yourself.
Okay.
And to adapt some healthy habit.
Okay.
So for example, one that I have that I've had for, I think, 22 days now is to read 20 pages of a book.
Nice.
And so I realize, I'm not reading much anymore, and I'm also just not doing anything because I have a lot of free time.
Sure.
So why don't I try to fill that with some quality reading? And so what I did is I created, in this app, you can create a streak with yourself, which says read 20 pages. And so every day I read 20 pages, I hit the button saying that I did it, and it adds one more to the streak. And the idea behind it is what Jerry Seinfeld said as the don't break the chain strategy. Mm. The idea is just to see how many days you can go without breaking the chain.
Sure.
And so now I'm at 22 days, and if today it's 10:30 and I haven't read yet, I'll be way more inclined to read because it preserves 22 days worth of work.
It's interesting you mention this because to me this loops back a little bit to the external internal motivation mm-hmm. that we were talking about before, and sort of I've heard this term, and I don't remember where, maybe you can help me, but the gamification of mm-hmm. various media sources. So I think when Snapchat first came out, to go back to that, people said, not going to last, just a fad, it doesn't offer anything special, and yet here it is being now, soon to be, if not already, being publicly traded.
It is now, yeah.
Publicly traded, okay. And considered a very successful company. When I learned about this streaks, just from my students in piecemeal, it made perfect sense to me. Mm-hmm. Because it gives you an incentive to come back to the app. Even if maybe you're not inclined, but it's 9:30 at night and you've got a streak of 162 days, you are very, very motivated to go in and, whether it's meaningful or not, to send that snap. And from a business perspective, how brilliant, right? You've got people coming back day after day after day. And the more it goes, the more inclined you are, the more buy-in you have, right? If it's 500 days, maybe that's impossible at this point. I don't know.
People have streaks of 500 days.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you're at 500, how inclined are you to get 501? Far more than the difference between 1 and 2. It's an exponential difference.
Well, here's Mr. Johnson not knowing Snapchat. You can't have a 2-day streak. Fun fact.
Oh, wow. I'm
sorry.
Starts
at 3, but it's all good. Yeah.
I show my foolishness once again. Okay, so the difference between perhaps 3 and 4.
There we go.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you. The difference between 3 and 4, far less than, although it's only a difference of a day, the difference between 500 and 501.
Mm-hmm.
How brilliant by Snapchat. And yet do we realize, we probably do on some level, realize how much more inclined we are to go onto Snapchat to keep that streak alive. The reward is what? What is the reward of day 501? Maintaining the streak, which is a purely external motivation. Is there internal? I don't know.
I don't think so. I mean, because isn't the desire to feel like to fit in, basically, to have, I guess, quote unquote, friends?
Yes.
Isn't that internal to some extent?
Yeah, probably is. I suppose
right?
It is.
And so this is validation of that. So sure, the number is external, obviously.
Yes.
But the fact that
the
it symbolizes, it feels internal.
Yeah, that's true. And so maybe it starts externally, but builds into internal.
And there's some people that don't put much thought into streaks. Most people probably don't.
Probably.
And it just becomes a habit to go in and send streaks or to keep a streak alive.
Right.
And actually, this is a habit for myself. Two times a day at about the same times, mm-hmm. I go onto Snapchat and go through all of the streaks that I have, which most of them end up being meaningless. I mean, there's just no content. Usually it's just a picture of my face. And it is replied to with a picture of their face and it just goes back and forth. There's nothing there.
Yes.
But that turns, it still forces me into the app twice a day at minimum.
Absolutely.
And then there are some people I'm having an actual conversation with, which then, adds to that. So Snapchat is doing something pretty brilliant,
I think. Yeah. And I think it's fair to say, and I don't mean to throw out there that all of these communications are meaningless, because I'm sure that they're not. However, it's fair to say that I bet many of the communications are surface level at best.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, how much can you really get across in one photo with some text? Some, certainly. But not something where you'd say, wow, do you remember Snap 134 in our streak?
Well, it wouldn't be phrased like that.
No,
but people
of course
would be
not.
Like, remember that time I snapped you about blank?
Sure.
And that sometimes is there. And there is something to be said about how a picture-based means of communication.
Absolutely.
Because you can encapsulate a lot more information sometimes in a picture than you can through, 10 texts.
1,000 words.
Yeah. Right?
Pictures worth 1,000 words. So it's obviously working. It triggers something in our brain that says this is good for many of us, not for all of us, certainly. But it's worth considering, at least, I would say. It's worth considering if the habit is worth the payoff. If you've thoughtfully considered, yes, this streak is important to me. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with two people saying, hey, remember that time we had a streak of 1,000 days? What's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that. It's just, are we aware of how much time we've spent working on that streak?
And it's not just the time sending a snap, because that could be 5 seconds. It's not much. It's also the time you spend thinking about the fact that you haven't done it yet.
Absolutely.
That happens to me personally, especially in the evening, because if I forget to do it, then that could be, if I forget in the morning too, it's done.
Sure. And perhaps the worry throughout the, let's say there's a day where your teacher took your phone.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine the despair that some students might feel with, think about all of my streaks?
Right. Or people going on vacation.
Good heavens.
Like a lot of people give their Snapchat to someone else
to
keep those streaks.
Sure.
I mean, that's a common thing.
And it makes sense.
Right.
From a keep the streak alive standpoint. And yet think of the planning time that goes into, hey, I need you to make sure that you've got my Snapchat so that you can keep my streak alive. I'm going to be on vacation from these days. That's all time lost.
And perhaps we're being a little cynical here.
Perhaps.
Because I mean, a lot of people do use it as an actual means of, talking to people or, don't put that much thought into it.
But
I think what we're trying to say is that you should put some thought into it and realize that it's more dominant in your interactions with people than people think it is.
And I think it's also worth applauding Snapchat, giving people something that they want. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing evil about that. And hopefully people don't think we're being cynical about the company of Snapchat, because good heavens, it is the job of a corporation to give people what they want, and that's exactly what they're doing, whether it be in a form of picture communication, whether it's through videos, whether it's through keeping streaks alive. I think the gamification of systems is something, like you said, with the reading. What is wrong? What is wrong with you reading 20 pages a day if you're doing it because of an external motivator like a streak, or if you're just doing it because you want to read 20 pages, you're reading 20 pages.
Right.
There's no reason, nobody needs to apologize for that.
What's interesting there, though, is with gamifying something, you're taking an internal motivation and turning it into something external, which usually is not what you do. You usually do the opposite, right?
Exactly.
You take something external that then develops into something internal. At least I feel like that's dominant.
It seems right.
And here you're taking something where it's like, I really want to read more.
Yes.
And that's just me wanting to do it for myself.
Sure.
And then saying, okay, now the way I'm going to keep myself to that is to have this external motivation. And I think something that's interesting here is, I can't remember where I saw this idea, but the idea was basically that you front load the difficult stuff when it comes to creating a habit.
Sure.
So for example, in this case, when I decided I wanted to read more, I created the streak and I committed to it early. And so I think the term is a motivation wave. That's the term they use.
Oh.
So when you hit a motivation wave to do something, you set up all the systems then. So in this case, I set up the system that would keep me accountable for reading.
Absolutely.
And then 20 days later, when I don't care as much, the me from 20 days ago did care and set up the system for me now to just continue it.
Brilliant. Yeah.
So I think one of the things here is that you should, when you want to create a new habit, you should capitalize on a motivation wave, because when you realize you want to create a new habit, that's when you're motivated.
Absolutely.
So do all the difficult things then, so that future you, 20 days later, can just coast.
Yes, absolutely. That makes perfect sense. And in the case of the reading, right, the reward for you when you begin is, I want to read more. Whereas 30 days down the road, when you say, you know, I could do something else,
right,
then you've got other built-in rewards.
So when the internal motivation, you know, ebbs and flows and kind of goes down, the external is still there to keep you
and
accountable.
And the beautiful thing about the internal motivation building is, and the streaks is, as you go, the power of it builds, right? A streak of 20 is better than a streak of 10.
Right.
A streak of 200 isn't just better than a streak of 20. It's way, way better, exponentially better.
And the really cool thing about that is, early on when you start a streak, that's when you're in that motivation wave.
Yes.
So you might be able to get to 10 days off that wave.
Yes.
But at that point, then the numbers become big enough that you just want to keep the streak.
Absolutely.
So you're capitalizing fully on the wave to get to 10 days when it's really difficult.
Yes.
And then the rest of it just hopefully follows.
And
now, I've lost like 40-day streaks on this app before.
Sure, sure.
But it's not like, then I just wait for another motivation wave to start up again. And
so
that comes right after, because I feel bad about missing the day usually.
Right. Well, and so to sort of math nerd out a little bit here. So if you think about a cosine wave, if at the beginning, the cosine, the maximum of the cosine, that's when you set up your system. If you add that to the exponential curve, which starts out small and meaningless, right? Cosine x plus e to the x, you've got it. And as you get further and further down the line, that external motivation can pick up those dips,
right,
those low spots. The question I have is, and I don't know the answer to this, is on an exponential curve, let's say, you know, you're in the middle of your streak 150 and you lose it. Is it harder to get that motivation wave back? That's a question I have. I don't know. Because, oh my gosh, think how long it took me to get back to 150. It's not even worth starting again. I don't know. I mean, what's the answer to that? Or is there an answer to that? Because that could be one potential pitfall of, if the system's flawless and it works, because by golly, it's so motivating that you're never, ever, ever going to let it go, which seems unlikely. But if it's a change that really you want to make, that you need to make, the things people often, weight loss, dietary changes, sleep habits, study habits, if you really need to change it, is that big buildup going to be enough if you lose it for one day? I don't
right.
know.
So the interesting thing is that I've actually killed streaks of 70 days before. What I do is when I hit 70 days on a streak, I remove it from the app.
Interesting.
And the reason I do this is because when I hit 70 days, that means I've probably internalized it.
Oh.
And so the app, things I've removed have actually continued regardless of me having to go into the app and mark down.
So you've lost the training wheels.
Right.
Essentially.
Yeah, I've removed those training wheels and now it's internal. Mm. So the external motivation was there until I was able to turn it into a routine for myself. And once I did that, I never had to think about it. It just became something I did daily. Like my daily routine, which I do every morning, I've done thousands of times now, so I don't think about it, right?
It's right.
It's basically the same thing.
So maybe an effective way to change your routine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's some science on this, and I'm not sure how well established it is, but after you hit a certain number of days of doing the same thing, that's when it starts to become a habit.
Mm.
And so it's finding ways to create this habit or to change a habit that makes it conducive to having habits, new habits in the future.
Sure. Well, so here's another question that I have. Is it worth changing your habits? I mean, right. It sounds like, and from what we've talked about, it's not an easy thing to do.
No.
It takes some mindfulness. It takes some planning. It takes some preparation. It takes recognizing those moments, those motivation waves, as you call them, and really capitalizing those. So is it worth it?
I mean, right.
What do you think?
So one part of that is you have to put in a lot of time and mental energy to notice the problem and find a way to fix it.
So identify the problem.
Right. And so there's this great XKCD. It'll be in the show notes. I think it's 1205. And it basically says how much time you save and how often you do the task. And then it tells you how much time that'll save you in 5 years.
Oh, wow.
So the idea basically is if you change your routine so that you save a minute every day,
yes.
Then over the course of 5 years, you'll save a whole day. You'll save 24 hours.
Wow.
Now, this gets better when you're doing something like saving 5 minutes five times a day.
Mm.
Then you're saving 4 weeks.
Ooh.
In 5 years.
Oh, that sounds worth it to me.
Yes. So I can't think of something I do five times a day for 5 minutes. Maybe eating,
well,
I guess.
I will give you one example as you talk about that. And I've actually referenced this in a way, especially with my ninth graders.
Mm.
Now, I get them for 2 hours a day. And oftentimes,
oh, sure.
They'll say things like, oh, Mr. Johnson, can't we just take a few minutes off? Can't we just... Or a great routine that all classroom teachers should have is starting right when the bell rings. Okay, so the bell indicates it's time to be quiet. Right? It's time...
It's a routine.
Talking. It is a routine, unless the teacher allows that routine to slide. Because human nature, bell rings, but this teacher in front of me is sort of laissez-faire about the beginning of class. Well, it's fine. It's just 30 seconds. It's just a minute. It's just 2 minutes. Well, in a 180-day class year, approximately, school days, if we just spend 2 minutes a day where we're not doing anything at the beginning of class, not to mention the lost sort of productivity that occurs throughout the class periods. That's 360 minutes. That's 6 full hours. And like I've told my classes before, if Mr. Lindbergh walked into my classroom and said, hey, guys, what are you doing? Well, we're taking this is day one of our 6 full hours off. He probably wouldn't be too happy. So I think being mindful of routines and being able to change them isn't probably worth the time in some cases.
Right. And for the listener, Mr. Lindbergh is our principal here at JM.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Nico.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that's part of it, I think, the amount of effort that has to go into changing things, too, because you have to consider that if it's going to save you 4 weeks over 5 years, if you have to put in 3 hours right now to think through it, it's probably worth it.
Absolutely.
But there's something else going on, too, and there's this idea called decision fatigue.
Okay.
So this is an interesting concept, but the idea is that when you have to make decisions throughout the day,
mm-hmm.
that takes up some of your finite amount of willpower.
Hmm, interesting.
So for example, if in the morning you decide what you have to wear, you've expended some amount of willpower in that decision.
Yes.
And that means that since the theory is that there's a finite amount, and so as you go throughout the day and you keep making decisions, at some point you just can't make more decisions.
So what happens if you reach that point?
So for example, suppose you plan to work out in the evening.
Yes.
And at that point you get home and you've just, you know, you've expended all of your willpower. You get home and the default is just watch Netflix or something.
Ah, so it's almost like a willpower gauge.
Yes.
Interesting.
And so the interesting thing here is that there are famous people like Mark Zuckerberg who wears the same thing every day. And the reason he does that is to reduce one more decision he has to make, especially in the morning.
I love it.
Or myself, I set out what I'm going to wear the next day at night so I don't have to think about it in the morning.
Interesting.
So reducing decisions like that is something that I think should be thought about in habits, because your routine is eliminating a decision, basically, or multiple decisions.
Absolutely.
In the morning, if I'm going to do something or I have a set order, I don't have to decide what order I'm doing them in.
Yes.
I just do the things.
So maybe finding a balance between letting habits rule our lives,
right,
therefore not being mindful, not being present, not having control over our mental existence on one end of the spectrum, and then on the other end of the spectrum, having no habits, being completely sort of will-powered out at some point in the day, and then letting ineffective habits and routines sort of take over. Maybe somewhere in the middle is the sweet spot,
mm-hmm.
perhaps.
Right, because to change all of your ineffective habits would require too much willpower.
Yes.
Probably.
Yeah, yeah, I think you're right.
And so in doing that, you might be causing other problems.
Yeah.
Trying to change habits one place would mean that you're running out of willpower elsewhere.
Absolutely.
So.
Well, I do actually like the idea of one outfit. That's a pretty good idea.
Mm-hmm. So I think one more thing is that productivity does go up when you're in the habit of doing the same thing over and over again.
Sure.
Because as we mentioned earlier, it's kind of like you're doubling down on a system.
Sure.
And making it as efficient as you can. And so when you do something a lot, you just get better at it, right?
Yeah.
And so that's the doubling down. When you get better at something, then you just keep doing it because it seems to work.
Sure.
So I think that's one reason it's hard to break out of these habits.
Yeah.
And one reason that you should be hesitant in changing habits.
Yeah.
Because the transition costs could be very high.
Absolutely.
So when you change a habit, you probably experience some sort of withdrawal. I mean, I know that when I've been working with streaks and changing things, I know that you kind of want to default to something, and then
sure.
when you can't, it's a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah. Changing habits is not something that our brain probably wants to do. Now, when we're at the top of that wave, the top of that motivation wave, we say, hey, I want to change this in my life. Taking advantage of it, you're right, is key. Because there's going to be down times when you say, oh, God, that chocolate would be good. That I don't want to go for a run. I don't want to read. I don't want to. And yet when you, I think if you ask people, well, what are some qualities of a fulfilled life? They're going to say things like spending quality time with family. Or we all know the, quote, right answers to that question. And yet, how many of us engage in that? Me included, right? We all seem to distract ourselves, maybe just out of habit and routine, as opposed to knowing that this is a fulfilling activity.
Right. So, I mean, something you talk about in calculus, right, is that you have local minima and maxima and global,
yeah.
right?
Sure.
And so, basically, the idea is, on a smaller scale, you have different goals and priorities than you do on a bigger scale.
Yes.
But the problem is that the bigger scale is the sum of the smaller components.
Yes.
So if your bigger goal is to spend more time with your family, but every day you're not doing that, then
right.
when is it going to happen?
And the easy answer, I think, for all of us is tomorrow. We'll do it tomorrow. And yet, not to get too deep on anyone, but I don't think tomorrow is guaranteed for any of us. So I think one thing that we need to be mindful of is how we spend our time every day. And hopefully this discussion is leading us to that point of, how do I spend my moments? How do I engage my mind in that process every day so that I am attempting to reach fulfillment, that I am attempting to sort of strive to be my best person, and yet on that small and large scale? No one's perfect. I'm certainly not. And yet, are we at least mindful of it? I think that's the first step, is identifying that maybe we do have some things that we could tweak. All of us have some things that we could maybe tweak and look at in our own life to say, yeah, you know what? I could maybe do that a little bit more effectively. I could maybe change that habit a little bit, change that routine a little bit, and maybe be happy about it, be more productive, or be more happy, or be more fulfilled, or whatever we're looking for in that habit. But it does take some self-reflection. It's not easy. If it were easy, everyone would do it. So I encourage our listeners, as you sort of exit this episode and maybe take some things away, hopefully, that you take away maybe an introspection, maybe a bit of, that's interesting. I wonder what my routines are. I wonder what my habits are. Are there any that I love? Are there any that I don't love? And could those be changed for my own betterment and fulfillment?
Mm-hmm. All right, so I think that's a good stopping point for today's episode. If you'd like to send us feedback, you can do so at solvingsystemspodcast@gmail.com.
We love your feedback.
Yes, yes. We've actually enjoyed hearing from Mr. Johnson's former students, some of my friends, just people that know us.
Yes.
It's been very nice to hear people's thoughts. We've also got some suggestions for future episodes that we're planning to work in.
Absolutely.
At some point. So if you've got something that you'd like to hear us talk about, we will definitely listen to that.
Yes, so, absolutely.
Yeah, so you can get to us that way. We'd also like to thank the people that have helped us make this episode. I want to thank Katie Holzer for editing. We want to thank Drake Thomas and Ben Durstein for some of the suggestions that went into the content. And so if you'd like to give us some feedback, leave a review on the podcast store. And if you'd like to just subscribe so you can keep up to date with our latest episodes, we'd really appreciate that. So.
Yes, absolutely. We appreciate all feedback, good, bad, and otherwise. It helps us learn. It helps us figure out what people are interested in, what people want to hear, what people don't like to hear. And so it's all good. The more you can reach out to us, the better it will be.
Yes. So thanks again, and we're looking forward to recording our next episode soon.
Yep. See you next time.